Thank you for attending the session 173, Five Views of Joseph Smith, or Sunday School Psychotherapy, Mormon Poets on Vulnerability and Madness, Healing and Hope. Excuse me. Before we begin, we ask that cell phones are turned off and that those attending will be respectful and attentive. It is the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. Please keep that in mind when engaging in the question and answer portion at the end of this session, following the remarks of the presenters. Those who cannot abide by those guidelines should refrain from commenting and will be asked to leave should they become disruptive. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. If you haven't already, please consider subscribing to Sunstone Magazine at the registration desk as well. Your support goes directly to keeping symposiums and 40 years of thoughtful dialogue alive and sustainable. Don't forget to check out the bookstore in the ballroom hosted by Benchmark Books. Consider purchasing a book or two to support Mormon studies and scholars. This session is 90 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. Brigham Young once called Joseph Smith a poet. And poets, Brigham continued, are not like other people. Their gaze is deeper and reaches the roots of the soul. Such vision, he said, is akin to having the searching eyes of angels. And with which poets can catch the swift thought of God and reveal it to us, even at the risk of forgetting their underclothes and their suspenders. A poet sees differently than others see, and to see differently is to risk mental, emotional, social, and spiritual instability. Come and hear original poems by six Mormons that meditate on these themes. The presenters will be, in this order, Alex Caldiero is UVU's poet in residence and author of many books of poetry, including Some Love, which is by Signature Books. Jessica Dixon is a high school English teacher at Slate Canyon Detention Center in Provo, Utah. She is also co-founder of Speak for Yourself Open Mic, a successful weekly creative writing open mic in downtown Provo. She took a liking to performance poetry in 2010, quickly got involved with the slam scene, and she has never looked back. Marianne Hales Harding is a poet, essayist, and playwright. Her plays have been produced in theaters from New York to Seattle, and she was the playwright in residence at the Tony Award-winning Utah Shakespeare Festival at USF. She was featured in USF's New American Playwriting Project and was a finalist in the Actors Theater of Louisville National 10-Minute Play Contest. Her work has been adapted for film by independent filmmakers and published by Brooklyn Publishers, The Silver Birch Press, Everyday Mormon Writer, ePregnancy, and Rocky Mountain Running Magazine, among others. She received her MFA in playwriting from Ohio University and her BA in English from Brigham Young University. She is the co-founder of Speak for Yourself, a creative writing open mic and community in Provo, Utah. Robert A. Reese is an educator, scholar, and poet. He currently teaches Mormon studies at both the Graduate Theological Union and the University of California, Berkeley. And poet and essayist Bonnie Schiffler Olson, sorry I skipped over you, I didn't mean to, shares a home with five rambunctious artistic children and her philosopher husband, Mark Olson, in Provo, Utah. For 27 years, she has wandered the maze of bipolar disorder, mitigating effective turbulence through music, movement, and language. She is co-founder of Rock Canyon Poets, has served as editor-in-chief with both Utah Valley University's Touchstone Journal and BYU-Idaho Scroll, and occasionally offers mild, constructive comments when called upon in both Sunday School and Relief Society. Her stories, poetry, and essays have been published in Likewise Folio, New Bourgeois Outlets, Touchstone Journal. Is it Bourgeoisie? Is that how you say that? Bourgeois, okay. Outlets, Touchstone Journal, and Dialogue, a journal of Mormon thought, and she blogs at www.secondsetofwings.com. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. Tyler was supposed to be here to moderate this session, and he sent a note out saying, would somebody take over? And since I wasn't doing anything else at Sunstone, I decided that I would since I was reading poetry here, I would step in. I'm very pleased. Clifton Jolly, who was supposed to be reading today and may not make it because he said that he was not feeling well, I said it's okay. Sick poets can also read. Anyway, he and I did a session of Sunstone at Weber State a few years ago, and featuring a really good Mormon poet named Ron Wilcox. And I'm pleased to say that the attendance today is 5 times greater than it was then, which I think is an improvement for the future of poetry. I also know that some of you probably had your heart sink when you heard this was a 90-minute session. So if you and some of us leave before then, we will all understand why. Poetry, it doesn't make anything happen, as we are told. And yet, for want of it, men die every day, and maybe an occasional woman as well. I came to poetry late. By that, I didn't mean I was late for a poetry reading, but I didn't think I could ever write a poem or even teach poetry, but I ended up doing the latter for many, many years at UCLA and other places, and find it not only an interesting form, but one that seems to me particularly suited to a religion, because 60% of the Old Testament is poetry, which means that God speaks in poetry, even if we don't always listen in poetry. But I think that we should pay attention to what poets have to say. What did Robert Frost say?
Many things.
Yeah, many, many things. Yes, he did say many, many things. But he said that poetry is the thought felt thing. And this morning in the session, we were talking about the heart and the brain and the relationship between them. We think about poetry as both a combination of thinking and feeling. Obviously, there's thought that goes into it. Obviously, there's feeling. Somehow, when the thinking and feeling come together in a way that sometimes surprises us, it's always a good thing for the world. So today, we're going to have poets reading their poetry. I told them that if each person took 12 minutes, we would probably end up someplace close to occupying a good part of this time. If Clifton doesn't come, we may be reading more than 12 minutes. And I'm sure that everyone here is prepared to read more than 12 minutes of his or her poetry, or to make some up on the spot, and who would know the difference? So, it seemed to me that there is an order here. So let's do that. Alex, Jessica, Marianne, Bonnie, you can go first, and then I will wait for Clifton and see if he comes. If not, I will bring up the rear. Does that sound reasonable?
It was Maya Angelou that said a poem is not finished until it is heard.
That's right. And you have suspenders on, so you don't count as a poet, Eugene. I have lost my underwear and my suspenders, according to Brigham Young. I'm here.
Horseradish.
I assume that's the title of a poem.
Actually, it's not. But horseradish. And it came to pass, verily, that there was a man who lived in a tiny portion of land, which was a remnant of that land that had been divided among the mighty and strong. And this man began to plant and work that small portion until he had enough for himself and his family. And then he noticed one day that his labor did yield much fruit, and he noticed that it yielded even more. And from this small piece of ground there flowed an abundance of fruits and streams, as to make all the other lands around it seem barren and meager. And the people of the other lands, who were the mighty and strong, began to whisper among themselves, and to murmur, and then to complain, and then to curse, and then to plot and scheme of a way to rob the man of his little piece of land, because they were sore and resentful and pissed off beyond measure. And so, verily, one day, as the sun was rising, as on any other day, they rose up early, and in the darkness of dawn they went forth toward the land that they had disregarded as useless. They went forth, every one of them, to destroy the inhabitants thereof, and to take possession of the land that has surpassed their own in bounty and beauty. And it came to pass that as they came upon the sleeping city at the very huts of that land which they so coveted, that the sun rose before its time and woke all the inhabitants of the city, so that they got up to see what the noise was about, and they came and stood face to face with a numberless army. And that man came forward to speak to them and said, "Why come you here to plunder that which we are only too willing to give you and share with you? There is plenty for all, even for you. And so lay down your arms and come gather and take as much as you need and even as much as you want unto yourselves, and this do for as long as you desire." The leader of the great army, on hearing these unexpected words, paused and thought and wondered and thought, and with a mighty cry gave the order to attack. For his mind was made up and his pride was full grown, and so they slaughtered every one of the man's friends, and the man himself they tortured first before spilling his blood. And it came to pass that they possessed the tiny portion of land and made it their own, and they were glad and rejoiced. Always ask, how long did it last? The longer it lasts, the less control you have over it. It being an episode of anxiety, of hearing voices, of thinking about your own destruction, of feeling you are the target of unknown forces. To any yes answer, follow it with, how long did it last? This will give you a good idea of how much control you have over the thought, the feeling, the premonition, the intuition, the image and or sound that visits and stays and eats and shits and departs or lingers unwanted until it is invited to leave, and it won't. It keeps on dishing out images and dialogues that are not part of the reality you want to belong to, where you can work and breathe regularly and fear no evil or what has no name you can pronounce or face you can describe. It's lasting too long, indicating you have little control. It's lasting way too long, indicating you have no control. You are controlled instead, and you waver, hoping to hang on a bit longer. To your surprise, you have that much control. It's over as quickly as it started, gone as suddenly as it came. Now ask yourself, how long did it last? You can't say. You can't say for sure. You can't remember. You can't remember exactly. You force memory door open, bang against it to no avail. You can't say. And after several tries, you relax and you do remember and see that it did last too long, that you had little or no control. Take note for next time, as there inevitably is a next time, another time to mount the mound and stand on top and see all round that it is round. The view from up there is round and whole, and it takes all into itself. It is yet another way to begin to hope again for the nth time, you lose count. You can't tell time. Scientists are developing stem cells to repair broken hearts. I knew that someday we would solve this ancient problem. Cut off from the world, one day you'll feel the world still present, with all the people, all the doings, and all the rush. But when you look, there's nothing there. The world cut off from your body still senses it. It happens so often, it seems so logical. As one amputee to another, we speak to each other. Tell of the emptiness that is undeniably present. Show each other the places that used to be full of life. My world gone, yours gone too, and yet present, ever present, phantom worlds. A tear can be held back, but can never be unshed. Once desire makes it bulge, and pain makes it fall, a tear's body is complete, replete with organs and sensations, perceptions and perspectives. Each tear is a perfect complement to that other before and after. Symmetrical and shapely matter, malleable and ever soft witness. A tear is, after all, a being born out of any wedlock, singly constructed and filled with gaze. Among the earth's creatures, not least, and in the atmosphere, a ghost. O fellow humans, your eyes primarily not for seeing. Allergic reaction. Move away. Body experience. Hands know and do show their reaction to subjects unknown. Elements cause them to itch in ways not natural, but nonetheless affecting the skin and brain. Itch not quite right, nor is rash. A disturbing reaction, not easy to make out, nor is the reason. Supernatural, because whatever is born, natu, naturally reacts. Born by touch, born by such, not easily discerned. Skin disturbance makes it known, or so you think. Answers not readily available to the questioners. Ability to mimic, activated not a moment too soon. Returning to this, a skin disorder, allergic reaction, object at hand unknown. Entities jump on, for example, mine. Cause said disruptions, even if washed or viewed microscopically. The bones in question, the question of substances, of proprieties communicable, felt telescopically. Infinity hurts. Count the moments and make them pass. A beginning is an uncertainty. An ending is so comforting. Mortality is what is wanted. To perish and change and become. Immutability is a curse. Infinity hurts. The pull of gravity, the push of love. May each moment last a moment and not a moment longer. How am I doing on time?
You had 10 minutes and 46 seconds, so you can read another one.
I did 10 minutes already?
Yeah.
Wow, that's pretty good. I thought I had done 11.
You now have.
Sitting next to Carl at some meeting, I tell him we ought to leave as the meeting is not for us. I turn to him and say, Carl, let's go. We leave the meeting. As we are walking outside, the person turns to me and say, why you keep calling me Carl? At that instant, I turn, and it's not Carl that I've been with, but some other friend whom I now recognize and say, I'm sorry, I thought you were Carl. I start to weep, because all this time I thought I was with Carl, who is dead. Until that moment, it didn't occur to me that he was dead. Thank you.
So I think an audience member wanted to know if they should clap in between poems in this thing.
Let's wait until
everyone's.
Unless one is so great you spontaneously burst.
I won't be offended by that. Okay, so now you know. Mystery's gone. My poetry is very different from Alex's, but I think that's what's cool about this and what's cool about poetry in general is it's a very malleable form of writing. So there's a phrase of sorts that says, if you want to give a poet a gift, break her heart. Or his heart, I guess. And that's just basically saying, like, poetry comes easier when it's from a darker place, I guess. At least that's true for me. Which is fitting for the blurb of our presentation. And I was originally thinking I would go from, like, most depressing to lighter and leave you guys in lighter, but I decided I'm going to do the opposite. I'm not going to be nice. Sorry. So we're going to start out light and go depressing because I think my better stuff is depressing, sadly. First piece is called Independent Beauty. If teaching has taught me one thing about teenagers, it's this. They have zero tact. Jessica, did you forget to do your hair today? Didn't you wear that yesterday? Weird, I thought you were Mormon. Why don't you have a boyfriend? The boyfriend question is the bane of my existence. What I want to say, what I do say, and what I should say all sound very different. I want to blurt out, because men are idiots. But that blurs into, gee, that's, I don't know, maybe you should, inappropriate question for me because none of your business. Then later comes a tangent, you know, what I would say if they asked again. I am a young woman, comfortable in her own skin. This is the face I wake up to every morning. May not always be ready, but it's always willing. This is the spine that stands up for me when I don't have the time to wait around for him. My chest that breathes just fine, voice that fills voids, eyes that hold light. I feel pretty badass and beautiful without a guy. Don't get me wrong, relationships are nice. Boys have the power to tear down my barriers and make me squirm at the scary exposure. Give me the right smolder and my knees might give. I'll even blush at a simple compliment. There's a reason why I like romance, but I refuse to be defined by a boyfriend. Having a companion doesn't seal your worth. I won't become suddenly beautiful and accomplished and confident with a man on my arm. Life won't magically become carefree. I won't set boyfriend as the goal to finally make me happy. Some people wait for that boy to shoot them into the stars, but one head and half a heart have gotten me pretty far. I know I won't be alone for long, nor do I want to be, but I deserve the time to choose who I'm with for eternity.
as cheesy as that seems. Anyway, you, independently beautiful and smart girls, you deserve it too. I get that boys are exciting and cute. It seems like everyone cool is dating someone, and that must mean they're special or superior to you, but don't let them make you feel diminished. Any suggestion that your life is less fulfilling or accomplished is ridiculous. If you do have a boy, that is good and honest, that only adds to your self-acknowledged excellence, then I am so happy for you too. Just remember, a boyfriend, or the lack thereof, doesn't have to define you. Now, that doesn't really answer why I don't have a boyfriend, but it tells you why I don't really care. Okay. Next one is called I Would Call Home. If you were to ask me for a picture of my home, I might throw down a U.S. map. Not the kind with brightly boxed out borders, but the topographical kind, with mountain peaks and deep valleys. You could run your fragile fingertips over its top. You can actually feel the beat of life. 300 million pulses pushing off the print, and I see the breath it houses within me. Each contour on the page is mine, my home, my play place, my grave. You see, I'm not dead, but my ashes have been spread, pieces of me lodged in the cracks of concrete, blowing in the wind like weeds in the prairie, hitchhiking rides on busy urban streets, blending with beachy sands and sea breeze, and forever settling in the vast lands of liberty. The seeds that are me have been planted in 7 different states, and yet I've never been as whole as I am today. You have to understand, I left behind my first precious words in Massachusetts. I tried to take in the world through my tiny hands and tiny feet, groping the floors, ceramic tiles, and toys laid within reach, until my baby eyes truly laid sight on the first 2 important people in my life, and their names escaped my lips with such ease, even I was surprised. Now my words and views fill pages that prove I've grown. Though anywhere my love for language was born, I would call home. Understand, I left behind pure, untouched beauty in Kentucky. Mother Nature raised me with bird songs and sibling hugs. I saw my reflection in the blue grass and blinking lightning bugs. My playground, a neighborhood without boundaries, a nearby creek, allowed my little frame to run carefree and unashamed bare feet. Now living for skin knees and tangled hair is the life I used to know. Though anywhere I learned that beauty is simplicity, I would call home. Understand, I left behind rampant replenishing energy in California. With the sun burning down on a boiling blacktop, I ran on my toes. Racing friends down a steep suburban hill, we went as fast as we could go. My mountain bike racked up mileage from my house to the ballpark. We giggled and watched boys in tight baseball pants swing for the stars. Now things look surprisingly similar, what I call running exercise, I suppose. Though anywhere that showed me movements not work, I would call home. Understand, I left behind the silly notion of conformity in Washington. I weaved unfazed through the halls despite a prissy girl's claim I wasn't popular, and when I rebelled and stood tall, her pretty face dropped in unmasked anger. A group of unfashionable tomboys never sailed through school so easily. We won basketball, volleyball, track, and band competitions without hesitating. Now my preteen years sound pretty embarrassing. I'm not alone, though anywhere that taught me individuality, I would call home. Understand, I left behind a naive kind of innocence in Louisiana. Turns out the creepy creatures and buzzing bugs aren't the only things that bite. There are inhospitable people that treat Yankee newcomers to hell out of spite. I constantly choked on the sticky, unforgiving atmosphere and the cries rising in my throat from an unaccepting year. Now 24-year-old me says I'd give it another try. I'm actually 27 now. Chances are I won't. Though anywhere that helped me cope with mankind, I would call home. Understand, I left behind a raw piece of my heart in Wyoming. A slow country embrace can replace the breaking parts of you, even when there is nothing but flat, dry land in your peripheral view. I genuinely laughed and generously loved under that wide open sky. The cutting winter wind is the state's only downfall that I can't deny. Now there's a scar in my heart where love and loss shows, though anywhere that took me in so fully, I would call home. Penned over time by people and defining moments, the map and I share the same legend. With blowing winds and moving bodies, who knows where my ashes have really been? Some are settling in the desert sand and salty lakes, schoolroom floors and mountain corners of this state, but understand Utah's still leaving its mark on me. I'm still leaving my mark on Utah. So I'll keep dropping pins in paper towns and claiming I'm from the United States of America. So I'm actually moving to Arizona tomorrow. So I guess if I wanted, I could write another stanza to that poem, but I don't know, I feel like I might ruin it if I do that. So. Okay, and these last two have more closely related with religion and such. It's called Spare Human. Losing who you are is not like losing your keys. You won't find yourself right where you left you, just as you left you. You'll flip over so many hollow bed sheets, search boundless spaces on desperate hands and knees, and relive once forgotten days, smothered memories, only to realize you're not sure what you're chasing. You won't find something you can't define, and if who you are has changed over time, how do you know what to look for? Panic starts to set in as you catch every reflection in every window, every mirror, and where you were once sure to be is a spare. Only slightly familiar. Certainly, it looks the same to the eye untrained, same hands, same mouth, same strength, but you'll feel the difference in mass and substance. You'll know the shift in purpose and perception. It will be slightly unsettling. But you won't give up that easily. You'll steal away free seconds to continue your search because losing who you are is not like losing your keys. You won't suffer silently as the only one who has lost something. You can and will sift through every littered sermon, peruse countless opinions from helpful strange humans, and lift up cushions that held friendly consultations, finally to find comfort in hearing about who you were. And there will be a slow acceptance that life is not stagnant. Who you are and who you were are not completely separate. You're subject to evolve, just like everything else unbalanced. You're not a spare human, but a human, period. With a questioning mind and a life unrefined, and a predictable nature of getting lost from time to time. So losing who you were is not the same as losing who you are. And losing who you are is not the same as losing your keys, because you'll never lose your keys just so you can find them. All right. Last one is called Time Bomb. If I have the darting eyes and sweaty palms of a suicide bomber, it's because I carry around a crudely wrapped package made of my own device. You see, my beliefs are a bundled dichotomy, wrapped up in brown paper hypocrisy tied neatly with the string of doublethink. I am a ticking time bomb. That's what happens when you let a culture, a religion, and a life experience all play surgeon with your chemistry set. I have the veins of an electric highway, crisscrossing wires, pushing blood to the old ticker. Every day I'm pumped full with more combustible contradictions, and the clock is running down. In Sunday school, I lost 30 seconds when love thy neighbor sounded a lot like save thy neighbor. I lost 25 seconds when being Christ-like looked a lot like being a pompous, prejudiced ass. 12 seconds when I read that research about religion making us happier, more hopeful. 15 seconds when I saw an atheist use his own moral compass. 8 seconds every time I realize a part of me won't make it out of this alive. I've never been good at making decisions, especially when the outcome is destruction. There's no SWAT team for a faith crisis, no matter how protective they think the word is. Do I keep the red charge or the white? The reds of the world or the whites of religion? Snip the white wire of religion and watch everyone I love get hurt in the blowback. They'll be picking up the remnants of their confidence in me for years, constantly piecing together what they could have done differently. I'll be freer but burdened with survivor's guilt, occasionally getting grafts of the present to make up for shaming the past. I won't look the same. No one will look the same. Snip the red wire of the world and watch me implode. I'll look the same, but will be a shell of who I want to be, always subconsciously trying to regain my individuality. Everyone will look the same. Especially since I blew away all my nerve to disagree. I won't feel the same. I already don't feel the same. 5. Oh, I feel sick. 4. There's no SWAT team for a faith crisis. 3. No SWAT team. 2. What should I do? 1. What should I?
Thank you.
grab something while you.
So now I've done open mics for so long, and so, certainly many more open mics than academic type settings, that it feels really weird to me to have nobody clapping between. It's very hard. So I understand the pain that you're going to feel, because you're going to really, really, really want to clap. But to reward you for your valiant efforts of stifling your natural desires, you're going to hear more of my poetry. So it's all good. It's all good. I know. Just for you, Austin. Just for you. So I'm going to start out with a piece. Well, when I looked at what pieces to take, I looked at the blurb that was written about what we were talking about, and it seemed to me that it was talking a lot about vulnerability. And I feel like that of all the genres that I write in, my poetry is really the very most vulnerable, because I'm not hiding behind a fictitious character. It's just me, just out there. And so it is intensely vulnerable, and these are some of my most vulnerable pieces. But I'm going to start out with a piece that I wrote in response to the idea of an open mic, and of it being an uncensored open mic, and especially here in Utah, that tends to be a loaded phrase, this uncensored open mic, like we're all just, let's all gather and have an orgy and go to hell. But that's not what an uncensored open mic is, and this kind of gets to what I feel, why I feel it is important to have that kind of a venue. So this is called No Man's Land. This is a reenactment of what happens when you are introduced in Relief Society as a theater artist. Oh, I did theater in high school, but then I decided I didn't want to be around those kinds of people. Thank you. It's somewhat similar to the reaction of many theater folks when they find out you're heavily involved in organized religion. Oh, I used to be religious, but then I decided I didn't want to be around those kinds of people. Thanks. You could say I have dual citizenship in two warring countries. Countries with a somewhat permeable border, but a huge problem with friendly fire. Because even though most of the bombing campaigns aren't aimed at me personally, it's impossible to set up house in no man's land without acquiring some wicked scars from misdirected grenades. I know what sort of Christian I am and what sort of Christian I am not, but it still gets under my skin when someone rants about Mormonism. And by rant, I don't mean explore personal experience and come to a different conclusion than I would, or even angrily denounce something I hold dear. And I know what sort of artist I am and what sort of artist I am not, but it still gets under my skin when it is assumed that anything raw, anything that hits hard, anything that's rough around the edges, isn't worth even listening to. I know which grenades are aimed at me and which are not, but that doesn't mean they don't knock me off my feet when they explode. Could this please be 10 square feet of Provo, actually, okay, Salt Lake, that doesn't have a landmine, where we can be raw and open and personal and vulnerable and safe, where no perspective is deemed more valid or more truthful than another, where you don't assume I'll grow out of my theology, and I don't assume you need to be rescued from yours, where we don't stand here yelling at each other and never see beyond the propaganda enemy on the newsreel, where we start with the assumption that we are all good, smart people doing our best. Isn't this where a lasting peace starts? Isn't writing a quest to understand and be understood, to take something foreign and make it familiar, to make peace between two warring concepts, to make us all residents of no man's land, if only for 7 minutes on a Thursday night? And I take this moment while you're clapping in your minds. And thank you. Oh, yay, thank you, Austin. And then this piece, I'll just do it with no explanation, because it's a cute little one, and it's not cute. It's not cute. Okay. What I like about bruises, they linger. If you happen to forget that jumping off a cliff is a bad idea, they remind you. If you second guess your pain, they validate. When people see them, you don't have to pretend to be okay. People don't look at them and say, well, there's two sides to every story. And although skin and blood vessel heal much quicker than heart and soul, they seem more real. abstract pain condescending to take physical form, heartbreak, anger, fear, stupidity, rising to the surface and dissipating slowly into the air. This next piece is kind of still under construction. It's really new, but I love it. So you'll love it too. Two Easter mornings, 4 years apart. We called her Emily Lara's twin because they were both born on Easter Sunday, though neither was due until later. The one, an imperfect miniature of the other, a baby doll the doll baby could have held in one hand. Born 4 years apart, they were bound to be fraternal rather than identical, two poles of a planet rather than twin moons in the same orbit, one born alive, one born dead, one creating a mother, one undoing her. Even if you have prior experience, pregnancy always feels theoretical at first. The reality of it dawns gradually over months, only feeling really real when it forces itself into your daily life. The reality of pregnancy, heavily pressing and stretching, makes the incoming child a certainty. But motherhood is still a foreign country, unfathomable to the uninitiated. Even after my first baby was actually born into the world, it felt odd to call her my daughter. It didn't feel completely real yet. The birth of a mother labors longer than the birth of a child. Perhaps it was because I was already a mother that this birth was quick. Second babies are like that, rushing into the world when least expected, shifting the whole dynamic in the ordinary, extraordinary moment of a mother holding a child in her hand. Theoretical pregnancy suddenly, simultaneously, 100% real and 100% gone. Mother birthed to mourner, with no monitors or epidurals, with no ice chips or dreams of turkey sandwiches, and with no one to note the time of arrival. Yeah, the turkey sandwich line does sound weird, doesn't it? There we go. This one is called The Luxury of Breathing. Tipped back again too far, the familiar panic of body craving air, blood rushing, stars littering the peripheral vision, pushing out as a new one emerges, crashing frantically against the tender film of the eyes, searching for the exit, lungs gasping in desperation and regret, thrashing made fruitless by the force of the water, the brain pressing against the skull, tectonic plates shifting, primed to confess any crimes, to reveal any secret. I'm guilty. I'm guilty. I admit I am guilty. A million mistakes led to this moment where nothing can expunge the water, nothing can pull back the tongue, nothing can restore the tiny burst capillaries around the eyes. Air may replace water, but the mind keeps drowning. The stars keep swirling. When ragged breath returns, it takes tentative steps, ashamed of its failure and ready to retreat again. And you know, I realized when I was putting this together that I have a lot of mommy poems. I guess I feel really vulnerable as a mom. But this one's another mommy poem, and it's called Ordinary Touch. By the time she was born, he was tethered to me by only two fingers. Two fingers of one hand lay limp in my grip, face forward, eyes locked on the TV, jaw rigid as it had been for 9 months. I was used to it by then. It's okay. I'll smile for both of us, I told him. His smile would return. It always did. The first baby had been a terrifying concept until father and daughter met for the first time at the ultrasound. The second baby, short-lived, left us both raw and wounded but clinging to each other. This baby was a forbidden topic of conversation until she intruded physically, the elephant in the room growing bigger and bigger and bigger. The sight of her, the sight of me, instantly chilled the air. As if to make up for earlier miscalculations, he withdrew entirely, like a kid who feared getting a girl pregnant by sitting too close on the couch. Ordinary, everyday touch became as longed for as a first kiss. To sit close enough to someone that your legs touch, to have a hand slip into yours rather than flinch, to bear the weight of a man's arm as you fall asleep. Days, weeks, months wore on me like a migraine, stabbing pangs of rejection radiating through my body, and throbbing in the background of dinner preparations and story time. Fearful of making it worse, I said nothing. It would pass eventually. A week or so after she was born, without any fanfare at all, without any explanation or apology, the arms returned to cradle me as I slept. I didn't dare breathe or move for fear of knocking loose whatever had just fallen back into place. And yet a sigh of relief moved through every muscle. Thank you, thank you, thank you. A week or so after that, though, the arms were gone forever. I couldn't even grab two fingers and hope the whole hand would reach for me again someday. In the hospital, I hadn't let them take the baby to the nursery. For 3 days straight, I held her. The little lump lay heavily on my chest when I slept, when I ate, when I read a book. Her whole hand wrapped tightly around two of my fingers, needing my touch as much as I needed hers. Definitely have to get water before this one. Rock up my baby in the treetop. When the wind blows, the cradle will rock. When the bough breaks, the cradle will fall. But I will catch baby, cradle and all. I sang it the other way until I had children. As a young mother, the song horrified me. Down will come baby, cradle and all. What sort of mother allows that to happen? What sort of mother celebrates an image like that in song? I refuse to sing that horrible song unaltered. Sitting there with 6 pounds of delicate baby sweetness in my arms, I couldn't bear the thought of her smashing through knobby limbs, pine needles poking and scraping, crying out and receiving no answer beyond the sickening thud of her own body on the rocky ground. Mothers are superhuman beings who keep their children from anything that could harm them. I save the day quite regularly, catch the cradle in one hand while the other continues to make dinner, run and dive to catch the cradle just in the nick of time, position myself so she slips out of the falling cradle and into the baby carrier without even waking up. I'm that good. But lately, I find I can't entirely shield my children from the cruelty of life. I try, of course, but the cradle still falls, and it lands in my arms with such force that I am knocked over, flat on my back, the wooden runners cutting into my stomach and shoulders, my head bleeding, my chest crushed under the weight. I am dizzy with pain, but I caught her. I caught her. She is bleeding too. Knocked about, scraped, hysterical. Nothing can break a fall from that height. And now you get the bonus poem. Oh, don't clap yet, don't clap yet. This is the bonus poem that you get as your reward for not clapping. I'm working on, well, actually what happened is I found that I had, we love to go hiking, love to go to see things, and then I just found that I had this pile of National Parks poems just sort of piling up. I'm like, I've got a lot of those. So then I started sort of cultivating them. And this one is when we went to Spiral Jetty, which is quite an expedition. I mean, you have to be really, it's got to be like a religious quest to get all the way out there. It's 34 miles on dirt road. It was horrible. But it was really cool. So this is Spiral Jetty. The landscape is a water landscape, despite the drought. The salty sand, distinct from the hot beach sand, ghost piers jutting out into the memory of a lake, water plants yellowed and long dead. It waits, Penelope-like, for a saltwater Odysseus, and even though the heat seals any moisture that braves the journey, the crashing waves feel imminent, as if the sound of Pharaoh's chariots will soon differentiate itself from the sound of the distant birds. A jetty without water is missing half of its defining characteristics, and so the water hangs about like a phantom limb. It twinkles on the horizon and teases our dry throats. If our collective will was as strong as the faith of Moses, we could crack the cloudless heavens and pour sweet relief on our dusty feet. But the black rocks of the spiral, strengthened by a decade of want, make a bold mark, and do not miss the swish of the tide obscuring their curve with a cloak of white. Ever the artist, Spiral Jetty embraces deprivation and makes it beautiful. Okay, now you may clap. Thank you.
Hi.
I'm Bonnie Schiffler Olson. It is a pleasure to be here. Today I will be reading you my series, Broken Vessels. It's poetry exploring the necessity to mitigate the existence of mental illness with our own LDS theology, the Odyssey. And these are found poems that I derived from a paper that my husband, J. Mark Olson, wrote and presented at SMPT entitled Agency, Disability, and Atonement. One, Sunday School Psychotherapy for the Bipolar, a found poem with daddy issues. He is a good parent, but there is not enough space in the boat for all of us heroic cowards. I need an excuse. Some are left in the psychological current, bound in Kantian irons and a counterintuitive duty to live. I struggle against the force of God's headwind, blown by the irrational weight of his belief in divided kinds of persons. He demands these differences, good and skew, level and mood, function and desire. I want to be committed, but the delusional damage is deep. It undercuts a moral stem, and atonement is a drag. It takes a psychiatric Christ to repair disordered reason, a borrowed weight to hold our bodies under, to heal the subtle spots on our reality, the flaws of internal experience. We need a physician against our false sense of rational acts, against the opposition of a parent incapable of seeing his mistake, blind to the suffering attempts of all his broken children. Two, Kantian want ad for the ideal Mormon robot. Required, complete persons who know they are greater than others, separate, differences clearly obvious, those neatly labeled, deserving of praise, sense damage, avoid others with questionable family history, social flaws, and poor genetics. Whatever the difficulty, filling their natural born character as a matter of duty and contempt for excuse. Strong all-or-nothing persons do not break down, know the way to flip the switch on mental snap, face death, choose life. Finished persons keep their word, will not abuse Christ with weakness, are rationally categorical, fulfill obligations and responsibility and responsibility and responsibility with no need to be forgiven. Good agents should answer by writing a profound letter. Three, intuitively wrong action. Persons depress some tasks simply impossible, but then much more difficult without impossible. For instance, that person with a severe moral obligation to a letter of thanks to a letter to a friend. Further, that the letter possible Oh, possible for this agent, but only just. A-N-C, A-Gen-C, A-Gen-C, agency in this case might well restrict altogether the letter, the let-er, the let-ter, et-ter, possible, but very, very difficult. 4. Disabled reason's second attempt at writing a letter. Friend, I give my word I am only just writing, radically constrained by the faces, their contempt, how they stare, because the saintly way exists in me. I am full of phenomenon, and they see. See all the weight of second roots of notions, how the body does not break. I blame it on the rough calculation, the causes in the literal two-word continuum. I am writing. We are not limited by relevant history. The real elements further the purposes of irrelevant interpretation. The labor of children born, brothers and sisters. We are all related to the literal hold of the body of the household, all in the family way, and we point to the heavy spots. What is right, friend? I am writing this bit of soul making, the attempts not limited to ends of existence, to flaws that want to leave the body. I am locked in impossible outcomes. I see you struggle against the severe surrounding, the forces of sin, reflection. I see you. I see, friend. It is as I say. 5. God speaks for himself, for Lehi, and for Kant. Some might be bothered that I could be interpreted as confusing, but I am. The problem of space and time restrictions, the I am nomenclature limited by empirical objects, the ought. There is no reflection, no we in the suggestion. What can a moral God do? The obvious, more and less. I weaken my infinite ability, advocating the cultivated struggle in a covenant demographic, creating types, a history of oughts, and certain kinds of misguided mental tasks, however I must, to mitigate my children's agency, to get them to safety. I hold this responsibility, the commitment to opposition. That is my reason. That is my end. 6. Christ contemplates atonement at the helm of the ship. How does one will to rise against this body experience? I have reason to question my ability to keep my word. From here, the way does not seem clear. We struggle, a family altogether blind, bound in certain death, and blown on a severe current. I take up the least of God's issue, and the greater. Brothers and sisters in reflection and all degree of character, and we hold on. My duty, to keep course, maintain a mild state of hope, but some are more afraid to get into the boat than others. The evil is deep. I have struggles of my own, a potential global loss, difficulties making sense of this planning even before the suggestion of the other above self. but the tremendous history of need, the outcomes of these lost children more relevant than all my weaknesses. It is hard to do the heavy act of healing, the unforgiving attempts necessary to give life, to make claim on the demands of their agent bodies, separate sin from the soul, repair the absurd suffering of madness to save purpose. Entirely difficult, if not impossible. I point this boat of empathy from captivity. I think I can see the way. By the time it is finished, we will arrive in more certain surroundings as one, an equal household, all of us justly broken. And this is for my husband. He had a stroke in April and he now lives in a nursing home. I wrote this in December, oddly enough, for someone else who won it in a Relief Society auction raffle, a poem for 10 points. I wrote it for her mother who had lost her husband a year before and was struggling. I think this is one of the hardest poems I've ever had to write. It's entitled, How You Will Live Alone. You will go on, noting the pressing half-light, the hollow of every shadow missing next to you on the pavement where you stand. You will listen for the memory of a voice, for that hopeful vibration, for some residue of a fading chord, for explanation. You will observe our marriage living in between, the persistent growth of hair after combs are misplaced, the nail beds mooning wax and wane against your teeth. Someone will always insist there is a future absence from this absence, as if winter were not the anticipation of spring, as if cold were not measured by the wanting warmth of sunlight, as if our love were not punctuated by these nights you did not intend to spend in silence. October will sometimes end in a pale shudder, like a collapsed lung gasping at another year come and gone that I intended to go on holding you. You will slip your hand into a patient glove to feel how we both are haunted. And you will know this lonesome divide cannot possibly be yours alone. Thank you.
I keep thinking that this sweet little girl sitting here on the front row will either grow up to be a poet or maybe wonder about poets and poetry. I was fortunate to, let me time myself as well here, I was fortunate to travel in China to take two groups of American writers to China in the 80s, two different trips. It's very interesting. And one of those, we went to a place in called the Hanshan Temple, where a great Chinese poet, Zhang Ji, many hundreds of years ago, wrote poems that were called, put into one called Cold Mountain Poems. And this is called Hearing the Hanshan Bell. This is at Hanshan. Hearing the Hanshan Bell with Gary Snyder and Allen Ginsberg. Gary Snyder gives a copy of Cold Mountain Poems to the old priest at Hanshan Temple. This book has finally come home. The bell sound in his heart, he rigs Jean-Gi at Fung Bridge and writes a poem. Sitting on Maple Bridge, Allen Ginsberg hears it too and writes a poem. On the train back to Shanghai, Masa, who is Gary Snyder's Japanese wife, who's from Japan and who learned Jean-Gi as a schoolgirl because they made a scroll rubbing of it, so she learned this Chinese poet during the Japanese occupation of China. Too much explanation, I know, but anyway. On the train back to Shanghai, Masa recalls learning Jean-Gi in a country school outside Kyoto, and she remembers every line. Echoes of the Hanshan bell. Met a poet, wonderful poet named Liu Xiaohe, who, like many poets, was sent out to pig farms during the revolution. His speech makes measured music in the old Sichuan dialect. He quotes Confucius, Walt Whitman, and Li Po, then tells the American writer her name sounds like pearls dropping in a dish. Hong Ting Ting. During the long darkness, Liu shaped hardwood and plane with plane and saw, fashioned cabinets tight as tombs. As witness to his children, he wrote poems in the night, and when the Red Guards came, he burned the scraps of paper and threw the ashes on the wind. These days, he stays home and writes old-style poems, which he calls Traces of the Sawtooth Ledge, Ciphers of Awl and Auger, and complains about young poets writing crazy verse. My children no longer read my poems, he says. They just rock and roll. Rolling Stones. In California, we celebrate the Day of the Dead, Dia de los Muertos, and here are two poems. Dia de los Muertos begins with an epigraph from T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland. I had not thought death had undone so many. At the Los Angeles Public Library of Day of the Dead exhibit, skeletons, skulls, and bones alive, the dead parting, dancing, drinking tequila, making love, going about their lives underground, nothing much changed except their skin is gone, and they are gone. In scene after scene, the dead go on their deadly ways, unaware that a few blocks away, other dead slouch in doorways, sleep in alleys, or walk vacantly along, their invisible skeletons asleep in their skins. These dead are not playing guitars, shaking castanets, or blowing trumpets. No mariachi or corridos echo from their mouths, nor do they frolic in the streets or dance down Olivera Street. Unlike Los Muertos in the library, their skin is yellow, their teeth brown, their hair matted, their eyes filled with blood. In the library, the dead are transformed. For them, everything seems a joke or a party. A skeletal mailman's leg is being bitten by a skeleton dog, and everyone laughs. But all along Figueroa, bloodshot eyes, smeared mascara, hanging flesh, the dead go on dying, leaving Los Muertos hanging on the library walls, very much alive. This is another Day of the Dead poem. Dia de los Muertos. Our grandchildren come from school and tell how during the procession they carried your photograph. Every day, my Day of the Dead. This is called Making the Bed. After once more making the bed alone this morning, tucking the corners of the bottom sheet, smoothing the wrinkles, folding the top sheet, adding the blanket, needed more now that you are gone, putting cases on the pillows, only one of which now softens my sleep in this small, solitary meadow of love and dreams. I want to crawl back in and just lie there. One of the writers I took to China was Barry Lopez, a wonderful writer of nature, and he's written a book called On Something Ground, and he tells about how when the Spanish came, they brought religion, but a lot else, and this is called Forgotten Birds, and it begins with an epigraph from a wonderful poet named David Hogue. Death is not sleep, but forgotten birds. The aviaries of Tenochtitlan held the sky's amazing abundance in their ribbed worlds. Cortez turned Tenochtitlan, which we know today as Mexico City, into what was called the Mexican Byzantium, this incredible city filled with aviaries and canals and all kinds of things. The aviaries of Tenochtitlan held the sky's amazing abundance in their ribbed worlds. White egrets, fierce accipiters, rainbow-colored parrots, vermilion flycatchers, copper-tailed trogons, blue-throated hummingbirds, summer tanagers, and great blue herons. The Spaniards heard the cantatas of birdsong, eerie, high-pitched, melodious New World sounds, deep-throated harmonies floating over the canals and gardens, and wondered. Then, at Cortez's command, they torched the caged corridors of wings, the pavilions of song, burning them all to the ground. What did they think, hearing the hysterical cries, the terror of stunted flight, the stench of singed feathers? What better, newer world did they imagine? One of the tragedies of the Second World War were all of the Japanese rounded up in California especially and sent to internment camps, including here in Utah and in a very unhospitable place in Wyoming called Heart Mountain. And this is about that. At the Japanese American National Museum, a pile of stones no bigger than a thumb, each with a single kanji, found buried at Heart Mountain. Each stone names something of the world: horse, river, flower, snow, kimono, sword, blossom, death, piled like a mountain in a bonsai landscape. No one knows why. I see her there, walking the fence, an empty riverbed that runs through the camp. She bends or squats to pick up stones, choosing each before placing it in her pocket. As she walks, she thinks of her son, buried in France, of her husband sick in the barracks with no medicine, and of her home in Fresno, inhabited by strangers, and of her daughter whose dreams lie dead along the San Joaquin. She dreams herself of a village outside Kyoto, of peonies in her father's garden, and plum blossoms on Mount Fuji. She fears she will go mad here, where summer dust blows through the walls and in winter no fire can keep them warm. Each day she picks up new stones and carries them to the tar paper room where they are prisoners. And at night, when everyone sleeps, she names the world and all of its parts: earth, apple, jade, moon, sun, dog, table, heaven, making them as real as these hard, round word stones. I have three more minutes. It's a poem about my grandson. It begins with an epigraph from Tobin Hart, The Secret Spiritual World of Children. Watch what happens sometimes when a young child is allowed to just have his or her feelings. The feelings usually run their course, and the child comes full circle. I'm sad. It feels like the whole world is inside me, says my 5-year-old grandson, naming the invisible darkness of heart, the black bile of soul that oppresses like an anvil sky. This ancient affliction, grief gathering to greatness, enemy the enemy of King Saul, Jeremiah, Hamlet, and Camus, of Wolf and Styron. Dowland sang it darkly, and Dickinson, oppressed by winter light, felt a funeral in her brain, generations descending to darkness. Even God, who sang the whole world into being, must feel it himself when the weight of history presses down, when sequestered hates and serial annihilations lean everything backward to chaos, and no flood or fire can extinguish the darkness. For some, it seems an eternity. For others, it passes like the going of a great storm, as with my grandson, who says hours later, "I'm okay now. The whole world is outside me." One more, since I have a minute. This poem about Joseph Smith called "Somewhere Near Palmyra." The epigraph, I'm fond of these, begins with Will Durant's, "The glory of the city was the temple of the sun." He saw everything that morning, deep among the leaves burning against the eastern sky. The sun and sun's radiance enfolded in oak and elm, visage of light luminous as seer stones, rinsing the still grasses, personages of fire, jasper and cornelian, dispersing the morning dew, images that bore him through dark of night, terror of loneliness, blood of betrayal, the ache of small graves, to death from the prison window where, wings collapsing, he fell through the summer air. And I know, kneeling among the secret trees this winter morning, where no bird song rings among the barren bush, and no leaves spring green, where darkness gathers, and where darkness thickens and gathers among the withered weeds, and my tongue is a fish under the river's roof, that I too see what he saw: sun, light, and fire, images of glory flashing through the morning mist. Thank you. So we have 5 more minutes. Anybody want to read a poem or sing a song or dance a dance?
How about
questions? Questions, yes. Anyone have questions about anything? I know it's hard to ask questions about poetry. It reminds me of hearing Robert Frost read Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening, and someone asked him, as was the want of 2 erudite graduate students, "People say that this poem is really about a death wish. Is that what you intended?" And Robert Frost smiled mischievously and said, "What?" Questions to anyone? Do you have any questions for the audience?
Really great poetry.
This is fun. I realize that it's really hard to listen to poetry, and I think in the future, if we do this, we ought to make copies so everyone has a copy to look at while the poet is reading, and it could probably make a lot more sense. But I think it's wonderful. Next year will be the 50th anniversary of Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. I was the second editor, and one of the great pleasures of being an editor was to get poetry from the best poets in Mormondom. And Dialogue, over 50 years, has published more good poems by more poets, more Mormon poets, than any other journal. So think about that this year as Dialogue celebrates its Jubilee year, and contribute money to support poetry. Thank you all very much for being patient, for coming, and making this fit audience, though few, today. And to all the poets, give them another round of applause.